You know where you are, but it's a pleasure for me. Okay. Esta conferencia fue provocada en parte por una pregunta de Maribel el año pasado y en parte por algo en el diario. Let me explain. That's Carrie Buck, who was the plaintiff in Buck versus Bell, which is the most famous of U.S. cases, a test case at the Supreme Court, with respect to whether the compulsory sterilization law passed by the state of Virginia was constitutional. I'm going to send around a timeline of when which state adopted a compulsory sterilization law, and it also includes some key cases. I apologize for my handwriting, but I think I can't possibly tell you all these details, and it's better that you have them. Okay. The abbreviations for the states, by the way, are the postcodes. Okay. All right. In the fall of last year, suddenly on the television and in the newspaper, I hear that the North Carolina legislature is discussing compensating surviving victims of its compulsory sterilization laws. And of course, I began to think about Buck versus Bell, which ruled the Virginia compulsory sterilization law constitutional and is one of Justice Holmes's most notorious rulings. And I'm going, my God, there are surviving victims? When did this end? In the spring of 2012, 2 days after I had returned the proofs of this paper to the journal, North Carolina legislature decides what to do. Each victim gets $50,000. I don't know what to think about that. It's such a strange sum of money. It's much less than many couples will pay for example, in vitro fertilization treatment. I don't know what to think. All right. Probably Holmes's ruling in Buck, for the majority of the Supreme Court, a majority of 8-1, that's already significant, is his most notorious judicial opinion. Anybody who does not like Holmes always mentions Buck versus Bell. And this leads me to ask, because I too find this ruling very disturbing, how should it bear on our assessment of Holmes's theoretical ideas about the law? And in particular, how does it bear on what he says about law and morality, where he has been accused of all kinds of terrible things, of which the most modest is moral skepticism, some kind of amoralism, and the most picturesque is brutalitarianism. That's not an English word, but I think you can figure out what it means. Still, Holmes is traditionally regarded as the first legal pragmatist, and I think this is right, because you can find a lot of traditional pragmatist themes in his legal writing. I should say, Holmes was a founding member of the Metaphysical Club, which was the little club in Boston founded by him and William James and Charles Peirce, where pragmatism was born. He never described himself as a pragmatist. That's not surprising, because the word pragmatism never appeared in print until 1898. And his big book on the common law was in 1881, and The Path of the Law was 1897, the year before James first put the word pragmatism in circulation. But there are a lot of pragmatist themes in Holmes. Okay, I'm just going to mention the most important. Holmes offers what's sometimes called a prediction theory of the law, by which he means, if you're an attorney and a client comes to your office and asks you, what is the law on this matter? What he wants to know and what you're obliged to tell him is what you anticipate the courts would decide if this were to go before them. That's known as the prediction theory of the law. It must be a theory, I think, focused on the attorney and not on the judge, because the judge can't be trying to predict what he will say. So it's a view about an attorney's picture of the law. It has very strong affinities with Peirce's and especially with James's statements of the pragmatic maxim of meaning, which says in, I'll give you James's version, Peirce's is more complex and probably in the end more defensible, but James's version is, there can be no difference, that makes no difference. So there's no real distinction if it doesn't make any difference in the real world. And Holmes seems to share this idea of it. I don't want just verbalism. I want to focus on what are the consequences. If I do this, what will the law do to me? Secondly, there's a marked stress in Holmes on how legal concepts change over time. He tells a very nice example of how ancient old courts used to punish animals or even inanimate objects who hurt or which hurt a human being. So if an ox gores somebody or if somebody falls down a well, right, the ox will be killed as the perpetrator of this crime and the well will be filled up. This is very peculiar. This seems very strange to us. And as he says, gradually our idea of responsibility changes so that only a human being can be held responsible for a crime. This is strongly akin to Peirce's idea of the growth of meaning, which is a very distinctive idea in philosophy of language, not found again until the late 20th century. And in the late 20th century, when Feyerabend and Rorty and people like that get hold of this idea, they think change of meaning is an impediment to rationality. That's not what Peirce thought. Peirce thought it was a contribution to rationality. And interestingly enough, when he first says this, when he first says meaning grows, he says this in lectures of 1868, which we know Holmes attended, and he's speaking specifically about scientific concepts, like planet, for example. When he next says it, it's 20 years later, and he's starting to talk about social concepts like marriage, money, law. So it's almost as if first Holmes listened to Peirce and then Peirce listened to Holmes as he applies this idea in the law. Holmes also talks very interestingly about the evolution of legal systems, how they change over time. Remember, this is in the early days after Darwin. Darwin's work was relatively recently published. Educated people were beginning to be well read in Darwin. Holmes, obviously, among them. And he describes a legal system as evolving like a plant, adapting to new circumstances, so that there's a very small version of the plant in the Alps and a very big version on the plain, for example. I once found what I thought was the perfect example of this, just perfect. In the Channel Islands, do you know what they are? Guernsey and Jersey, between England and France in the English Channel. There are these islands, which used to be French, and are now British. They have a system of professional jurors, unknown anywhere else in British, in English law. And I'm very curious about where this came from. And the answer is, in the 12th century, when these islands were part of France, France had professional jurors. It no longer does. And the islands are no longer French. But they still have this peculiar system. It's kind of like, you know, that one turtle on the Galapagos Islands? Solitary George, lonely George, poor George. There are no other turtles of his type any longer. He's the last of his breed. Okay, they're kind of like that. That would, of course, have been a wonderful example for Darwin. And in this, Holmes is very much like the other pragmatists, Hirst, James, and Dewey, all of whom were among the very first philosophers to read Darwin, to take him seriously. Dewey and James, I think, largely in biology, which is, of course, what Darwin is talking about. But Peirce turns the theory of evolution into a grand metaphysical theory, or a theory about how the universe evolved, how there came to be laws in the first place. Holmes insists that most distinctions are matters of degree on which the law has to impose sharp boundaries. You know, it's a matter of degree how drunk you are, but the law has to say, at this point you are legally intoxicated. It's a matter of degree how old you are, but the law has to say, at this point you are an adult. And when he speaks about the continuity of most of the concepts on which the law is imposing clean distinctions, his writing is closely akin to all the other pragmatists' distaste for false dichotomies. For example, Dewey's campaign against what he calls untenable dualisms, mind versus body, fact versus value, etc., 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 and the view Peirce calls cynicism, from the Greek for continuity, meaning look for continuous hypotheses, not for dichotomous or trichotomous ones. And in that context, he talks about, very unkindly, about people who do philosophy, I love this, with an axe. What do you get? Chunks of being, and you can't relate them. This is a disaster, he says. You can't explain anything if you do philosophy with an axe. The past and the future of the law. When Holmes writes about the law, he says, "Look, if you're really going to understand it, you have to look back to its history, because that's the only way to understand how it got to be like this. But you also have to look forward to the future, because you can't determine how to extrapolate an old legal principle to a new situation. Unless you ask yourself, well, what are we trying to accomplish when we do this?" He doesn't use this example because it's too recent, but I think of, for instance, the Supreme Court trying to decide whether the right to privacy extends to a public phone booth. Of course, there's nothing in the Constitution about telephone booths. There weren't any. But the only way to decide this is to ask, well, what were the founders of the country thinking when they wrote about privacy? What did they have in mind? And would we serve that purpose by extending this right to the public telephone booth or not? Okay. This is just like the other pragmatists who always are looking to the consequences and not just backwards. Holmes is kind of keen on the relevance of science to the law. I think it's almost unfortunate that he mentions specifically economics, because that means that the law and economics crowd think that he was their founder. I think that's a mistake. I don't think Holmes has any conception of economics as the kind of queen of the social sciences. That's the picture that the law and economics movement seems to have. But he does think, yes, economics is relevant, of course. His most interesting example, though, is about criminal psychology. I think this is a fascinating paragraph, where he says, look, you know, you're thinking about the criminal law and what you're trying to achieve. You see the connection with the last one. It makes an enormous difference whether the criminal is like a rattlesnake, you know, just programmed genetically to kill. If you annoy it, it will bite. And there's no way of stopping it. The only thing to do is to kill it or to lock it up so that it can't do its damage anymore. Or is the criminal more like, you know, and I'm going to be anachronistic again, you know, the young black man from the ghetto who has no role models, no, there are no successful people in his environment except the drug dealers. You know, what one wants to say about him is, well, he could be a successful businessman if he had the right role model. And if we put him in jail for a drug offense, he might be fixable. You know, give him a better example and he could be successful at something legitimate. I mean, of course, that argument of Holmes's rests on a false dichotomy, actually too. I mean, I don't believe all criminals are like rattlesnakes, or that all criminals are like the young black man from the ghetto. I think some are more like one and some are more like the other. And I suspect that it's not that you have to be either one or the other either. Right, that people may have combinations of these two. This is very similar to the other pragmatist aspiration, to bring philosophy and the sciences together. To get away from the idea that philosophy is this purely a priori enterprise and the sciences have no bearing on it, or vice versa. This is anathema to all of the pragmatist philosophers, two of whom I might say were trained in the sciences and not in philosophy. Peirce was trained as a chemist, and James was trained in medicine. If that counted as a science in the 1860s, I don't know, but anyway, he was trained in medicine for what that's worth. There's a specially close relationship, I think, to Dewey on the relevance of economics to ethics. Dewey says very firmly, you know, it's no good being too high-minded and supposing that economics has no relevance to ethics. That's a mistake. Of course it does. There's a level of poverty below which even semi-decent human flourishing is simply impossible. And we're being morally blind if we don't admit that. Then there's Holmes's moral fallibilism, or what I take to be his moral fallibilism, which I think is very close to James's and Dewey's approaches to ethics. Peirce on ethics is a very complicated story. If you ask me about it, I will try to reply, but it's very complicated and difficult. It's also, of course, close kin to the more general fallibilism that you find throughout the pragmatists. None of them is a dogmatist. I hope this is a familiar word. I'm thinking of a really terrible joke from a British disc jockey. If you get it, I will be very pleased. What's the difference between a dogmatist and a fallibilist? A fallibilist doesn't believe in pussyfooting around. Come on, gato. Sorry. However, this raises very controversial issues about how to interpret Holmes on ethics. And so, because it's going to be the core of my argument, I'm going to give it its own section. So, here we go. On many points, I think Holmes is right on these matters. Though, there are two issues on which I disagree. First of all, law and morality are conceptually distinct. Of course they are. To say it's morally wrong to overburden your secretary with trivial tasks, you know, go pick up my dry cleaning, you know, that's not proper. It's not morally good. To grade students' papers without actually reading them, which I suspect most of my colleagues in philosophy do. To judge by the grades they give them, their principle is, if I like you, you get an A, and if I don't like you, you get an A minus. I think that's morally deplorable. But it's not, neither of these things is legally prohibited, and to say that they're legally prohibited is to say they need something entirely different. Nobody's ever been prosecuted. Also, law and morality differ in extension. Not only are the concepts different, but they differ in extension. Many morally objectionable forms of behavior aren't legally prohibited, and some laws are morally objectionable. I talked about that last time, I won't make a big fuss. The evolution of a legal system, Holmes says, is connected with the moral evolution of the community of which it's the legal system. I think that's true. I think I have watched this happening during my time in the US. For example, as several states have now adopted, they've now made it possible for people of the same sex to marry. And many other states have made it possible for couples of the same sex to have many of the legal advantages of being married, even though they're not technically married. And not so long ago, the Supreme Court put its foot down, as we say, about the execution of underage criminals. You can no longer execute 15-year-olds. And it was clear that that was because there was a, there was a feeling in the country that this was just a terrible thing to do. Holmes also says the rule of the law contributes to the moral life of the community. I agree, it makes life predictable. It's very difficult to live in a certain situation where life is not predictable. Did you, any of you read what I did in the newspapers shortly after the Egyptians kicked out Mubarak? One of their problems was almost nobody in Cairo, or anywhere else in the country, I think, owns the title to the land on which they run their business or in which they, on which they have their home. Because the law, there's no law, there was no law about how to buy such things. It was all a huge mess. And that meant that nobody could ever be sure that they wouldn't be kicked out of their house or kicked out of their business premises because they had no legal title to it. And there was no way of getting legal title to it. And when you think about how awful that would be, you realize, even laws that don't seem to have much to do with me actually could. So that's my thought. And Holmes also seems to say what's morally right or best isn't something that a judge or anyone else can know a priori. I agree. That judges' intuitions, like everybody else's, are fallible. And that it's a hard question. What's the best arrangement from the point of view of human flourishing? I think, though, Holmes is wrong when he suggests that morality concerns only intent and law only overt action. I think that's just false. And I think he's way too optimistic when he suggests, as law evolves, it will get morally better. I don't think that's true at all. I think you can sometimes see whole regimes going backwards. Think of Nazi race laws or Jim Crow laws in the southern states of the US. Okay, now to Buck versus Bell. This is the legal history part of the story. The idea is actually very old. The idea that you could improve the human race by selective breeding and by preventing defective people from having children is it's a very old idea. The word, though it comes from the Greek for well-born, is relatively new. When I say it's old, it's found in Theognis in the 6th century BC. I know absolutely nothing about this guy except that he had the idea of eugenics. Nothing, sorry. But you also find this idea in Book 5 of Plato's Republic, where he's proposing a scheme of selective breeding in his ideal city. Right? Only the best people will be allowed to marry. Everybody will be given the impression that this is chance, that there's a lottery, but actually the lottery will be fixed. I don't think I would want to live in Plato's Republic. The word, however, wasn't coined until 1883 by Francis Galton, who was Charles Darwin's cousin. He was also one of the founders of the idea of fingerprinting. So he has a significant legal role, this guy. Very strange fella. Very strange. Darwin himself seems to endorse this idea in The Descent of Man. In The Origin of Species, which is 1859, he talks quite a lot about how human beings have changed the evolution of certain animals and plants. He was himself, we call him a pigeon fancier. That means he bred racing pigeons. And he knew that human beings could change. You know, they could make pigeons faster, for example. They could change the coloring of generations. They could change the feather patterns and so on. But he doesn't apply this idea to human beings until The Descent of Man. And there he sounds not as crazy as Francis Galton, but he's distinctly eugenicist. Why do we let people breed at random? No wonder that we get such a lot of feeble-minded and defective people about. I didn't know this until I wrote this paper. I had this it was a completely naive idea that eugenics caught on in Nazi Germany and that, you know, the rest of the world knew better. False. It caught on everywhere. Everywhere. North, south, east, west. Terrible, for example, in Scandinavia, which one thinks of as kind of civilized, but no. Very, very strong in Britain, where, of course, Francis Galton was urging these ideas. But among the people who endorsed it, I'm getting really quite shocked. Sir William Beveridge, who founded the British welfare system. Winston Churchill, who saved us during World War II. And, of course, it was big in the US. This is where your little handout starts being useful, because I'm not going to give you all the examples. The first compulsory sterilization law was passed in Indiana in 1907. The most severe compulsory sterilization law was passed in Kansas in 1912. Why do I say it was the most severe? Because it not only provided for the compulsory sterilization of the mentally defective, etc., etc., it also made it a criminal offense for the guy in charge of the lunatic asylum not to recommend sterilization for his patients. Okay, that's really tough law. California sterilized the most people, more than 17,000 by 1944. Okay, your list tells you when which state adopted these laws. It's not all the states, but it's a considerable majority. By 1924, however, a number of these laws had been challenged, and some of the challenges had succeeded. They were all constitutional challenges, of course. And there were two grounds on which challenges had succeeded. The first was, if you sterilized somebody as punishment for a crime, that was deemed to be cruel and unusual punishment, and therefore unconstitutional. And it was also held to be unconstitutional to sterilize someone without the appropriate procedure, which was held to contravene the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. That basically meant that the person concerned had to be given notice and that there had to be a proper hearing. You couldn't just whistle them into the operating room and conduct the operation without due process. I think you have to ask yourself just exactly what due process means if the victim is severely retarded. It's not clear that such a person is capable of understanding the notice or participating in the hearing in an appropriate way. But okay, that was established by 1924. And Virginia was listening. The state of Virginia was listening. It passed its law in 1924, having carefully designed it so as to avoid those constitutional barriers. Right? It was not punishment for a crime. It was simply a preventive measure to stop the feeble-minded from reproducing. There was provision for a notice and for a hearing, so it was not in trouble over the due process thing. It was even carefully designed to convey the impression that the compulsory sterilization was for the good of the, quote, patient. Why? Well, because somebody like Carrie Buck, who was allegedly a moron. Okay. They had categories of feeble-mindedness. A moron was somewhat cleverer than an idiot. Don't ask me. Right? There's a very nice little poem. Okay. Can you stand a poem in English? See the happy moron. He doesn't give a damn. I wish I were a moron. My God, perhaps I am. Okay, so Carrie Buck was allegedly a moron. That's to say, in modern terms, quite severely retarded. It was claimed that if she were left alone, you know, she would be pregnant every year with a child she was incapable of taking care of. And she and the children would be inevitably in the care of the state because she was not clever enough to look after a child. On the other hand, if she were sterilized, she would be able to be released from the institution where she was presently a patient or inmate, depending on how you want to look at it. And she could make a living, for example, as a domestic servant. She was chosen by the state of Virginia as the test case. Why her? Well, I think because she was the daughter of Emma Buck. It was said the illegitimate daughter of Emma Buck, but that's not clear. Emma was allegedly also retarded. And Carrie had herself had an illegitimate child, who was diagnosed as feeble-minded at the age of a few weeks, right, on the basis of, I don't know what to say, essentially nothing. One suspects the real problem with Carrie Buck was she had an illegitimate child. Right. You know, she wasn't terribly bright, and she had an illegitimate child, and this was a good way of getting this embarrassment out of the way. Okay, this case eventually came to the Supreme Court, as no doubt the state of Virginia hoped it would. Holmes, at the request of the Chief Justice, Howard Taft, wrote the ruling for an 8-1 majority. This ruling is very surprising. First of all, it's only 3 pages long. That's very short for a Supreme Court ruling. Right? Even at that time, it's very short. And there is only one case cited. That's astounding. Usually they cite at least 50. Moreover, the case it cites is not about compulsory sterilization. It's about compulsory vaccination. Okay? You can see what the argument's going to be. We oblige people to have their children vaccinated against certain diseases, even though there's a small risk to the child. It's quite small, but there is a small risk to the child. Because there is an enormous public benefit.
right? If enough people are vaccinated against smallpox, for example, the disease will die out. And this is a huge public benefit. So the idea was, Carrie Buck is like a carrier of some nasty disease. She's feeble-minded, her mother was feeble-minded, her children will be feeble-minded. See, there's a scientific assumption here. This is always hereditary. And it would be an enormous public benefit if we were simply to stop this nasty defect from being passed on. There he is in all his glory. This includes what is probably Holmes's most notorious line. Three generations of imbeciles is enough. This is completely illogical. This makes me crazy. Right? Look, if you really wanted to stop a fourth generation of imbeciles, you wouldn't just sterilize Carrie Buck, you would sterilize her daughter. Right? They didn't. So it's illogical. But what can I do? That's the story. There's Carrie with her mother. They don't, either of them look to me brilliant, but they don't look they don't look completely moronic to me either. They look mainly depressed. And who can blame them? They're in the institution, as you can tell by the dress. There's the poor baby with her foster mother. Looks like a normal baby to me. You know, they all look like Winston Churchill to me. She looks like Winston Churchill. At the time, the press reaction was really quite favorable. There's a whole lot of excerpts from the newspapers in my paper, but here are some of the most horrendous. Holmes's ruling is in accord with the most progressive tendencies in our social machine. Eek. It would halt the imbecile's perilous line. God, this is terrible. And this is Joseph de Jarnette. Oh, God. He was one of the witnesses of Buck's trial. Public health officer. Published an article after it was agreed that this was constitutional in the Virginia Medical Journal. Yards and yards and yards of dreadful doggerel, that awful, terrible verse. Oh, why are you men so foolish, you breeders who breed our men? Let the fools, the weaklings and crazy, keep breeding and breeding. Oh, God, this is awful. The criminal deformed and the misfit, dependent, diseased and the rest, as we breed the human family, the worst is as good as the best. This goes on and on and on. Actually, I found this poem not only disturbing, but also very interesting. Do any of you know a book by Sinclair Lewis called Arrowsmith? No? It's probably the best fictional reflection on the life of a scientist ever written in English. It was published in 1927, the year of this case. Its hero is a medical scientist called Martin Arrowsmith, and it's kind of Pilgrim's Progress of Arrowsmith. And one of the places where he works for a while is with a public health officer called Dr. Pickerbauer, who writes appalling verse about public health. And I think this is the model for Dr. Pickerbauer, right, who I thought was pure fiction until I read this. Awful stuff. Even in 1927, Clarence Darrow in the US and Chesterton in Britain were warning of the dangers of this kind of law. They were warning, first of all, the science is really very weak. We don't know much about when feeble-mindedness is inherited and when it isn't. And people are really just moving ahead way too fast on the basis of a very thin knowledge of Mendel's laws. And they both also saw that if these laws get in the wrong hands, the consequences could be really disastrous, because a Nazi or nasty government sorry, Winston Churchill always used to call the Nazis the nasties. And so a bad government would start sterilizing races it didn't like, for example. They saw this then, but the Supreme Court didn't. Holmes did. After Buck, not surprisingly, a lot of other states passed such laws, though there were more legal challenges also. The Supreme Court never overturned Buck, never. Remains law to this day. But in 1942, they returned to this case in Skinner versus Oklahoma. Poor Mr. Skinner. Okay, Mr. Skinner was convicted once of stealing chickens and twice of armed robbery. And he was in jail in Oklahoma when Oklahoma passed its compulsory sterilization law. And they moved to have him vasectomized on the grounds that he was a habitual criminal. Interestingly enough, in Skinner, the Supreme Court said that this law was unconstitutional. And they held that it was unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. Because had Mr. Skinner been convicted three times of, say, embezzlement, the law would not have said that he should be vasectomized. But since he was convicted three times of larceny, it said he was to be. And the Supreme Court held that this was treating different classes of criminals that were equally bad differently, and therefore unconstitutional. All right, so by this time, the law about how you decided equal protection cases had changed anyway. Used to be a very low standard for equal protection, which was how Buck got by the Supreme Court in part. You know, they said, but you're only sterilizing the people who are in the mental institution. And Virginia said, well, we have a good reason for that. And that was sufficient at the time. Now, by 1942, there was strict scrutiny of these decisions. And that meant that it was harder to get past the Equal Protection Clause, and Skinner failed to. In Skinner, Justice Douglas writes this. This is very modern. This is the first time a court writes anything remotely as modern sounding as this. We are dealing here with legislation which involves one of the basic rights of man. Marriage and procreation are fundamental to the very existence and survival of the race. The power to sterilize, if exercised, may have subtle, far-reaching, and devastating effects. In evil hands, it can cause races or types which are inimical to the dominant group to wither and disappear. This is 1942. People in the States know what's going on in Nazi Germany. But he still rules. Right? There's this marvelous dictum about marriage and procreation being a basic right, yada, yada, yada. But the ruling is on procedural grounds. So it's still the old pattern. You can't get by if the procedure isn't right, but you can get by substantively. That's why Buck hasn't been overturned. By the late 1960s, the Supreme Court's ideas about marriage and procreation was changing significantly. Here are three very important cases. I especially like the first. Loving versus Virginia, what a marvelous name, was a case involving interracial marriage. I believe it was a black man and a white woman, but I'm not certain. And in this case, the Supreme Court ruled that Virginia law forbidding interracial marriage was unconstitutional. Then there was Eisenstadt versus Baird from 1972, not quite so well known, which held that a Massachusetts law, according to which you could sell contraceptives to married people but not to single people, was unconstitutional. And then there's Roe versus Wade, which I take it everybody knows, which was the 1973 case, under which abortion was held to be legal in the first trimester of pregnancy. This is still very controversial. Rick Santorum is promising to go do something about it if he should be president, for example. It's still a controversial decision. But the importance of these cases for my story is that through them the Supreme Court starts developing this right of personal privacy. After which, between Roe and 1983, 10 states repealed their compulsory sterilization laws, including Virginia, which repealed the statute challenged in Buck in 1975. Okay, so Buck doesn't need overturning anymore because the statute has been repealed. But other states still upheld them, including North Carolina, which was where I came in, right, with Matabele of North Carolina, which didn't repeal its compulsory sterilization statute until 2003. Okay, well, an interesting story. I could actually keep going. Once I started the research for this, I could have kept going and made it an enormous paper, but okay, I didn't have time. First thing to say is that in the early decades of the 20th century, eugenics was seen as a scientific and as a progressive idea. The people who thought it was a good thing regarded themselves as progressive. The people who disagreed with it, for example, the one dissenter in Buck at the Supreme Court, the one dissenter, were mostly conservative and many of them Catholic. That justice was a Roman Catholic with 7 children, and thought that he was so far out on a limb it wasn't even worth putting in a written dissent. It was a progressive idea, supposedly. And so it's arguable that Holmes's ruling conforms to his theme that judges should look to science to determine what's for the good of society. It's arguable. But of course, this also reveals the danger that the science to which the court appeals might be weak, or it might have been oversimplified by the people who were trying to use it, or it might be out of date. And had Holmes and his colleagues done a bit more homework, they would have found that by the time of Buck, there was already dissent in the scientific community. There were plenty of scientists saying, look, first of all, a lot of feeble-mindedness is the result of accidents during a person's lifetime. It's not inherited, right? Things go wrong. You know, kids get diseases that wreck up their brains, for example. And not every feeble-minded parent will necessarily have a feeble-minded child, because after all, there may be nothing genetically wrong with the feeble-minded parent. And apart from a few very rare genetic disorders, we don't know very much about the inheritance of feeble-mindedness. And scientists were already saying in 1926, 1927, look, okay, Mendel's laws work for pea plants, but people are a lot more complicated than that. And the idea that you can just follow Mendel's laws and it will, you know, it's inevitable that the child of a feeble-minded mother will be fit, this is crazy. So they weren't very serious about the science, I think. To me, and I hope to you too, this ruling seems scientifically and politically naive and morally blind. But it's clear that to him and his colleagues, it seemed a reasonable sacrifice to ask of an individual for the sake of society. Hence the analogy with vaccination, right, which seems to me an entirely different matter, but not to him. For myself, you know, I read this ruling and I think, yeah. And Holmes is so brisk, as if, you know, look, it's obvious, go away, 3 generations of imbeciles is enough already, for heaven's sake. I really wish Holmes and his colleagues had half of Darrow's or Chesterton's insight, half of their ability to foresee the dangers. But I also realize, you know, others might disagree. You know, I'm thinking again of my Chinese friends and their readiness to endorse their government's one-child policy, for example. Or of another Chinese friend who tells me, well, We have no word in China for right. But this doesn't mean we don't have the concept. We do have the concept. But in Chinese, the concept is inseparable from the concept of virtue. So you don't have rights unless you have virtue. So the idea is of a right as something that has to be earned. Okay, and when I think about these people, I'm thinking, well, okay. I realize I have some strong moral intuitions around here, but I might be wrong. Okay. And hence my conclusion. For all of, okay, there's a famous book about Holmes called The Yankee from Olympus. Right, you know, he was very tall and very slim, and by the standards of his day, very good looking. He was of a very well-known family. His family was a famous physician who was also a poet. His father was a physician who was also a poet. The very topmost of Boston manhood, as they say. Supreme Court justice. And he's kind of detached. You know, we call this Olympian detachment. He's almost not quite human, you know. And much as I admire his writings about the law, sometimes I think, you know, he's so detached. He's not quite in tune with what matters to other people, always. And perhaps it's also relevant, I don't know, maybe. He was childless. His wife had rheumatic fever shortly after they were married. And this must have wrecked up her reproductive system. And according to one biography, Holmes worried for a while about whether he shouldn't divorce her because he felt he had an obligation to pass on his wonderful genes. And then he decided that he really couldn't live without her, so he didn't divorce her, and they had no children, which was perhaps partly why he could be so detached about this. I don't know. Still, even though I disagree with his ruling, I understand it legally, but I think if he'd had more moral imagination, he could have found a way to rule differently, and it would have been a better ruling. But what I think this shows is that he was right when he said, it's a misfortune if a judge reads his sympathy with one side or his moral convictions prematurely into the law. So the fact that he didn't practice in Buck what he preached in the path of the law shouldn't lead us to miss the point. This pragmatist philosophical insight, I think, is a good one. Right? And the fact that it's such a disastrous ruling when he forgets it confirms that rather than undermining his views about law and morality. As you can imagine, by this time, I'm kind of dead from sorting out this ball of wool, so, muchas gracias.